Thank you.
Colleen Camai, the natural nurse, bringing you the natural nurse, and Dr. Z, my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and myself, Ellen Camai, the natural nurse, bring you the natural nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we're so happy to be a part of Progressive Radio. And we want to thank you, all of you who are downloading our podcast. I looked at the counter the other day, and it was up to close to 113,000 downloads. That's fantastic. We love to have that kind of support in terms of listener interest, and we'd love to hear from you. So visit us at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or go online to naturalnurse.com and hit contact and send us an email. We'd like to hear your thoughts, your opinions, and what else you'd love to hear about right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can always join us in person as well, because we have many classes going on, both on ground, where you actually come and hang out with us physically, and online, where we hang out virtually. Starting in June, we have an 8-session course in autoimmune disease. That's a very high level. Anyone can take it, but that's a course specifically designed as evidence-based information for physicians. It's based on the book we wrote, Arthritis, the Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide, and it's going to be in June, every Monday and Wednesday in June in the evening. And that is an online credited. You get CEU credits for taking that course. So if you're interested in that, you can email us at naturalnurse.com through the website, and we'll give you information. And we also have lots of on-ground classes where you can come and learn about edible and medicinal plants. And we have another Chinatown trip coming up. That's in September. We just did one about 2 weeks ago. It was completely filled. And those always do fill, so it's not too early to get online for that one. Well, we'd love to introduce you to our guest today, Mr. Tony Martinez. He's a Food and Drug International Trade Attorney, and he was directly involved with the passage of the landmark Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, and at that time, we had Tony on our show several times. Talk about the politics of that day, which we'll be doing today as well. Also, he's been involved with other FDA-related measures. He's a patient advocate and involved in international trade, which is a big topic today. Tony has been involved in improving trade relations with Latin American countries, including Cuba. And also, Tony has a personal health link to natural medicine because he's a type 2 diabetic that has successfully put his condition in reverse and remission. Use of a ketogenic diet, low-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, and also improved his cardiovascular profile. So we're very happy to have with us here today our guest, Tony Martinez. Thank you for joining us, Tony.
Good morning, Ellen, and thank you for that very nice introduction. And it's a pleasure to be on your show and speaking to an audience that is really, I would say, enlightened and interested and eager to learn and open-minded and exploring, new solutions, new approaches to all the things that we encounter in our daily lives, especially things like our health.
Well, in terms of your bio, it's funny because it reads like, what's in the news today? I mean, everything that you're doing is really linked to major, major events. And then, of course, we'll talk about your personal journey with your health as well. But
sure.
We did a show a couple weeks ago on the pending fast-track trade agreement that is currently being discussed, and of course that has to do, I guess, with also South American countries. I'm just interested in your personal or professional opinion of that particular action, if you'd like to share it.
Sure. I mean, let's think about it from a basic perspective. Trade is important. Trade is the basis upon which countries and people at a very basic level have relations. And the challenge has always been What is the balance? What is the right way to, what kind of agreements and trade relationships are the ones that are mutually beneficial to both sides in a maximum way? I mean, ideally, that's what you want. Taking into account a whole host of factors. And it's not an easy it's not an easy thing to do because there's so many competing interests, and government in general does not always have an easy time putting together trade agreements. Now, with that said, we have to ask ourselves, what are we trying to accomplish with our trade policy, the United States with the rest of the world? Well, one, obviously we want to get a good deal because there are goods and services that are valuable and important for us to provide to other countries as well as for us to import to our country. Now, that also involves looking at things like, okay, what are the impact that those relationships have to things like, are we helping to reduce poverty abroad through our trade, by our trade policy? Because that's an important thing. I always say to people who are always being critical about immigration, I said, well, maybe if we had, you know, if we had trade policies that helped fight poverty abroad, there'd be less of a pressure to come to the United States. But easier said than done. That's one aspect. Another one is environmental, labor standards, because the labor standards of one country is different than the labor standards of another. So how do you put together agreements that will strike some kind of balance of fairness of treatment to workers? Because regretfully, how people are treated in some countries around the world is just despicable.
It is, but what keeps those labor costs down? So I would say big business would prefer to keep it that way.
You can, but you can also do things more intelligently, you know? I mean, I don't think anybody wants to be buying or wearing goods that were made with basically slave labor. Or if they knew that people really suffered and were treated horribly for whether it's clothing or whatever it is, they might think twice about that. But, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But again, trade, in principle, I support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, trade in its essence is a good thing because it keeps people connected. It keeps countries together. But again, you have to have an agreement that I would call intelligent, smart trade, because free trade can mean a whole lot of things. But that's, we can talk about that on another show. But it's an interesting topic, and it's something that everybody should take an interest to because trade is what connects us to the rest of the world.
So you think, if done correctly, that this particular fast track could be a positive thing?
Well, you know, the fast track comes from one other aspect, and that you have to ask yourself, do you want, and I'm not saying President Obama, but do we want, as a country, the President of the United States to be micromanaged by the Congress on every kind of commercial deal that's out there? It's really just about striking a balance. What's the right balance of power? And so what the President wants the authority to expedite the commerce quickly. Sometimes on trade deals, time is of the essence, or there's an opportunity that will never come to fruition if not acted upon quickly. With that said, Congress wants to be able to assert its role in providing a check and a balance on the power of the executive, but you have to ask yourself, ultimately, what's in the best interest of the country? You know, Thomas Jefferson said his basic concept of U.S. foreign policy was trade and commerce with all nations, alliances with none. Very interesting way of looking at what the potential of trade has in terms of international relations and diplomacy.
Well, so we'll see how that moves along. Now, another thing that is, of course, you are an international trade attorney. And
yes.
You have a lot of participation in what's going on in various areas of Latin America and the world. And since you even wrote your bio for me, I mean, things have changed in Cuba.
Yes.
So what, yes. Isn't that amazing? I mean, so what is going on now? Because, of course, our entire political relationship with Cuba is vastly different than just a few months ago.
Yeah, well, finally, we are in the process of normalizing our relations with Cuba, long overdue, not an overnight process, and not a process that's not happening without resistance by some hardline politicians, mostly Cuban Americans who exiled, that are do not want this normalization effort to happen. But clearly, after more than 50 years of failed policies like an embargo, travel restrictions, basically a policy of economic and political isolation and humiliation, that, you know, has demonstrated that's not the way to promote things like human rights and democracy in a country that is literally 90 miles off our shores, off of Florida. Anytime you travel to Cuba, it's the most surreal thing when you leave Miami and you get up in the get on the plane. Literally, by the time the plane ascends, it's already descending, and in less than an hour, you're landing in Havana, and it's a whole other world.
So apparently, the way you're describing this, Tony, is that you've done this often, and I do want to tell our listeners you are listening to Food and Drug and International Trade Attorney Tony Martinez, who has a lot of information to share with us on current issues in the world today, as well as global medicine.
I'm a partner with the law firm of Gerstmann Schwartz in Melito. We are based in Garden City, Long Island, and Wall Street in Albany. And we're a very busy firm, and I'm in charge of the food and drug practice and the Latin America trade practice that we're developing there.
There's a lot of what's going on right now. So what's a good way for people to find you?
Very easy. We have two websites. You can go to Gotham, GOTHAMGR.com, or GerstmannSchwartz.com, GERSTMAN, Schwartz.com.
Okay.
And it's a very exciting time because there's still an embargo, so you cannot travel, you cannot go to Cuba for tourism purposes. That won't be permissible until the travel restrictions are lifted and the embargo is lifted.
Oh, you know what? I'm surprised. Didn't I see that that big tall guy with red hair who's a star? He was just doing some shows there.
Oh, well, he did his your
Conan.
Yes, well, he wasn't there as a tourist. There's more like there's a section that allows for cultural exchanges.
Okay.
And so in that, in art. So there's 12 different categories that American citizens and nationals, permanent residents, subject to U.S. jurisdiction, can travel legally to Cuba. You just can't go to Cuba to go to the beach and hang out. But you can go there for people-to-people exchanges. You can go there to actually help Cubans who are privately employed, have their own businesses, help them build their businesses and help rebuild their homes, those kinds of activities, humanitarian, sports, professional research. There's all kinds of categories that will allow it, but you just can't go there to just go hang out at the beach and be a tourist.
So not tourist, but let me ask this, Tony, since this really spans both your professional and your personal interest in natural medicine. Michael Moore, as I'm sure you saw his movie, Sicko.
Yes, Michael Moore, yeah.
a while ago, but he really based, he went to Cuba and took patients there and really outlined the fact that they actually are higher than the United States in terms of medical outcomes in many cases, even with a huge, minute amount of money being spent per capita versus what we spend in the United States. And they still have what we would call integrative medicine, where they use a lot of natural techniques along with more modern techniques.
Yes, there's no question that the Cuban philosophy, what they are most proud of is the fact that everybody gets health care and every person can get a college education, and that it is built in the mindset of the society there that those two things are a basic right. Unfortunately, the economics have been, are challenging. They've always encountered and they still encounter the limitations of their economic model, which is, socialism. But not that said, I still think that, to have a society where everybody knows that they're going to get basic health care and that, every young person or every person doesn't have to worry about they're going to be bankrupted in either getting medical treatment or getting a college education. Keep in mind that that's a great point on right now student loan debt exceeds $1 trillion, and that is an astounding sum of money, and there's no mechanism there's very few mechanisms to alleviate that debt burden, and it's very difficult for our young generations now that are graduating college or going to college to think that they're going to be faced with basically the cost of a mortgage just to get their education, let alone they're getting a start in life and maybe want to settle down and have a family and have a home. These are the challenges that we're having right now to the middle class.
Yeah, because between rent almost anywhere in the country where there are jobs and your student loan, you really have to stay living with your parents, or a lot of couples sort of are living together in terms of young people, because no one's, usually don't go out in the job market and make over $100,000 a year, which is what it takes for basic bills plus paying those college loans.
It's a challenge, and I think those are questions and conversations that everyone out there who's a voter, and if you're, if you're a U.S. citizen and you're not registered to vote, you need to be registered to vote, because any of these issues that you care about, you have to and be counted at the ballot box. That's our system, and you have to get in and make time and talk to the candidates and really start demanding and questioning what their goals are and commitments are in, running for office. But getting back to the whole issue about with Cuba, so Cuba has a healthcare system and an educational system that is a transcendent type of system, because, like I said, even though they're a poor country and their economic system is really not really working well, they still have a system where they get tremendous medical outcomes in certain things, and they're a highly educated population. When relations are totally normalized and the embargo is over, Cuba may very well be a hub of a great deal of economic activity, like a Hong Kong, of the Caribbean, because it's connected to everything North and South America. It's right there in the center of the Caribbean.
Yeah, so it's going to have, quite a bit of importance. But, for instance, when my dad, who's now, God bless him, a very, very healthy and vibrant 89-year-old, when he was in the Navy, that's where they used to go for vacations.
Cuba was the Las Vegas, the Paris of the Caribbean. It was the place to go for the holidays, and people that lived in Florida people literally would hop on a ferry or on a plane, leave in the morning, and be, you know, spend the day in Cuba and head back home in the evening, because it's literally that close.
So we'll see how that develops. So it sounds like a lot's going on there. There's all kinds of changes, you know, positive and negative, I imagine. Although to my mind, it seems more positive. Anything that could be more open and less repressive must be a good thing. Now, politically, I'm not sure if you're aware of where do you see that evolving? Because, of course, they have Raul Castro, but also they're both getting elderly, the Castro brothers, let's put it that way. So what is the future?
There's another gentleman who's a vice president and on part of the what they call the Council of State, named Diaz-Canel. And he's been named to succeed Raul Castro in 3 years. 3 years
okay,
from now.
Okay, so we already know that.
Yeah, no.
So that I didn't realize.
And he's been named. And, you know, I think Cuba's political system will evolve. And the best thing that we can do is be a good neighbor, extend the hand of friendship, and have a dialogue. But telling other countries how to run their governments and how to treat their people, that has not been a very successful model for us. And we've also been very hypocritical, because when you look at the demands that we've placed on Cuba, you have to ask yourself, well, why aren't we placing those demands on China or on Vietnam or Saudi Arabia, which is these are countries that have authoritarian states with repressive rule. And yet they are among our closest allies. There's no travel restrictions. There's no embargo. So how is it that we can have one approach for a set of nations and then a different approach for Cuba? That doesn't make sense. That has made us look very foolish in the international community, very hypocritical. And there's no reason for it. We need to be consistent and congruent. And we can do that, and we can promote that a different approach. So, and that's what I think President Obama has been trying. You know, that's the goal of his Cuba initiative at this time. What it means for a lot of people is right now, what are the exceptions to the embargo right now are you can sell agricultural products, food, medicine, telecommunications, you know, these are things that will they're authorized as long as you follow the procedures that are set forth in the regulations and in coordination with the Treasury Department. You get what's called the licenses and from the Commerce Department. I mean, those types of exports are permissible, but there's still a long way to go. There's been an opening for Americans to interact with more and do business with the emerging private sector in Cuba. Right now you have about 500,000 Cubans, private businesses, excuse me, there's more than that, that are growing, and Cuba's population is set to be almost, you know, close to 40% of its population will wind up being self-employed, privately employed. So they are going to have to adjust their economic model. And that bodes well, because we will, you know, just the United States has a distinct advantage over any other country. We're the closest to Cuba, and we have such a rich integration of peoples and culture. Cubans love Americans. Americans love Cubans. You're going to see this really evolve.
Well, you know what? We're going to take a little break here, Tony.
Sure.
I know time flies. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion, and let's talk a little bit about FDA, natural medicine, and your personal story with handling diabetes. So we will be right back with more right here on Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
And hello, thank you so much for joining us once again right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're so happy to be with you, and we love to see you in person, either sort of online or actually on ground, walking right next to us, for instance, in Chinatown or out in the field. In Old Bethpage Restoration Village, it's called Restoration Farm. It's a beautiful, beautiful, huge organic farm in Old Bethpage, Long Island. We have classes all summer long in outside herbal identification and medicine making, where we actually make medicine out of wild plants, and you get to take them home yourself. So we'd love to see you there. We also have herbal certification classes, and we act as providers, as a mentor for those of you who are going through taking courses for your American Herbalist Guild certification, which is how you can become a recognized herbalist in the United States, and we act as mentors for that program. So that's another thing you may want to look into if you're looking for a career in natural medicine. Today, we have as our guest Mr. Tony Martinez. He is a food and drug and international trade attorney. You can find him at Gotham, GOTHAMGR.com, which is great. And we know Tony a very long time because we spoke with him way back when he was working and was directly involved in the passage of the landmark Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. And Tony, getting back to that, you know, that's still in place, but it seems to me like there's some kind of concerted effort, because every single week lately, there's a big thing on the news that's saying how dangerous natural medicine is. That seems like a political maneuver for me, because it seems to be very trumped up.
Well, you know, let's look, it's been 22 years since the act has passed.
No, that's impossible.
I know, that time flies. I remember when I was working on it was the time when my son was born, and, you know, today he's turning 22 years old.
So, oh, God bless. I can hardly believe that. It seems like yesterday
and,
to
he's
me.
He's graduating college, and he's headed to law school himself. Time flies. And, you know, the law has had its challenges because, I mean, structurally, the FDA never liked a law that would limit its authority. And basically, the Shea Act did place some limits on the FDA's authority, and it's the automatic inclination of the FDA to regulate more than regulate less. But the challenge has always been that the way that the Food and Drug Act was written, it was always my impression that Congress never intended or never really looked at the difference between foods and medicines and understanding the differences between the two, or that foods could have properties or actions like medicines, and that the structure that was put in place is really not the best fit because, I mean, our drug approval process is designed for, is designed for single chemical entities. These are like the drugs. And these are what, you know, and every drug company is looking for its next blockbuster drug and billion-dollar drug. And it's not necessarily looking, you know, when was the last time we had a cure for anything is the question.
Yeah, you're not allowed to use that word, actually.
Yeah,
right.
So, I mean, these have been some of the, you know, challenges that have been faced by, you know, the whole system. Our system has always been challenged by this. So, you know, supplements, at least what we accomplished with the Supplement Act is at least created a category where we obligated the FDA to look at these products differently and treat them differently. No one's saying that they're, you know, you're allowed to market unsafe products. There's always been the requirement that these products be safe. And in fact, because many of them are derived from food and botanicals, they were given the presumption of safety. But this has been a challenge. This has been a challenging area of the law. Now, 22 years later, the discomfort that the FDA has had with supplements and the supplement industry has had occasionally, not a lot, but every now and then, you know, a few bad actors that have helped hurt the industry. They're always trying to get somebody in Congress to push for some type of reform. Now, I think at some point the act will be revisited, but hopefully what's going to happen is there'll be a more intelligent approach, something that will make it easier for people to learn about how these products can actually help their health, make the system a little bit more intelligent so it doesn't have to be so doggone costly. You know, that's the thing that we fear and that we're concerned about, that if you place all these burdensome requirements, you're going to take them off the market.
Right, exactly. Because let's say something like homeopathics, which they were carrying on about last week. It seems like every week they come up with something. They went to a shelf, took homeopathics off the shelf, and tested it and found there's no substance in it. That's correct. That is the definition of homeopathy. There is no
But homeopathy challenges logic and reasoning and not very well understood. And the approach that's applied is very logical, scientific, and yet we haven't come up with a way to really understand the mechanism. But that's just a separate. That's a separate issue about homeopathy. You see
talk about herbal medicine, like echinacea. There's so many studies available showing that it actually, we know the mechanism of action very often. With echinacea, we know the mechanism of action is to actually increase the activity of white blood cells. Yet you can't really say anything like that on the bottle or tell anyone about it, even on a website where they sell it. You can't even have the studies showing on the website in order to support the use of any kind of supplement.
Well, it's because of the way the law is written, and, I mean, we can have a whole discussion about that. I mean, that's really an entire show's worth of discussion. But, you know, what I like, the way that this has been resolved, at least, for example, in Europe, the European Commission, the Commission e-monograph system for botanicals, where they've come up with, you know, standards of identity, of ingredient, mechanisms of action, and they make the product available to people, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cost a fortune. You know, it isn't a $500 a month drug. So, you know, these are the things that, you know, discussions need to be having the next time that the legislation gets revisited, and I expect it will be at some point, probably within the next 5 years, that there'll be discussions on, well, how do we assure access to product and information in the most intelligent way, in the least costly way possible?
Because, well, that's an important because if they start requiring a full 12-year double-blind study, placebo-controlled effect like they do with pharmaceuticals, first of all, that does not necessarily lead to safety, as we see with the adverse event profile of pharmaceuticals. But in addition, someone has to pay for all of that. So a bottle of herb that might cost $8.99 now will cost $150 12 years from now when they go through
all that. We don't want to do that. We don't want to make healthcare unaffordable, and it's already extremely costly. So, yes, I agree with you.
So do you feel that there's, you know, to me, since I've been doing herbal medicine literally since 1964, talk about going back in time, and nobody was too interested in it then because it was not exactly impacting anyone economically in terms of the use. But now I really believe it is. When we look at Expo East and Expo West, which I'm sure you're at, the Natural Products Expo, and there are 60,000 attendees, and the natural products category is one of the fastest growing segments of the economy in the United States, it really is beginning to impact pharmaceutical sales. Because if people choose to eat a healthy diet, live a healthy lifestyle, like yourself, how much less drugs are you using because of the actions that you've taken? And then once
I got a kick when my pharmacist called up because I discontinued a prescription, and I said, you don't want to go on Renault. I said, no, I'm done with this particular medication.
Oh my goodness!
It was kind of like a surprise in the voice. Like, wow.
It's not made to go. They don't want you, it seems, to ever necessarily go off.
Like they tell people, right. Yeah, they tell, like, they tell anybody who has type 2 diabetes, they tell them that, you know, you're resigned to the fact that there isn't going to be anything you'll be able to do about it. And you're going to be on this decline, and you're going to be on more and more medication, and that's, you know, you're going to be your lot in life. And that's not the case, and it's infuriating when you discover, and maybe this might be a good time to segue to my personal.
Yes, we can,
you know,
start on this. More break,
yeah,
but it's okay. Yes, why don't we start discussing that? It's a perfect segue.
Yeah, that why didn't they tell you that, hey, if you have type 2 diabetes, it means that you have insulin resistance, which means that you are not processing carbohydrate well. You may not even process it well at all. Your body can't handle the load of carbohydrates that you're placing on the body to the point where the insulin can't keep up to stabilize the blood glucose numbers, and you reach diabetic levels and the cascade begins. But they don't tell you, you know what, stop eating these carbs, cut your carb intake, start figuring out what is a safe, healthy level for you. Cut your carb rates down to 20 grams per day. Get your body into a state of nutritional ketosis, fat burning, where now your body is no longer worrying about trying to metabolize glucose, but actually taking advantage of all the fat stores that you've accumulated by the result of your overeating these excess carbs. Excess carbs are converted to fat and stored. And that really this is a disease about insulin more than anything else. My journey began really with a traumatic event last March. I had, relatively speaking, a minor heart attack. And even though every heart attack is serious, I had a minor one where I didn't collapse like you see in the movies. I just experienced a great deal of discomfort and incredible pain in my chest, but I never collapsed or lost consciousness. And I had to have a stent placed in my heart. And that just led me to look at everything that I had been doing, everything I had been eating. And I had been taking Janumet for my type 2 diabetes, and even my cholesterol wasn't even that high at admission to the hospital. It really left me with a lot of questions. I heard about a documentary, and I recommend to the audience to rent it. You can rent it online for $5, or get the DVD on yekra.com. The documentary is called Serial Killers, like cereal, like breakfast cereal.
Oh,
cereal
good
killers.
Name. I never saw that one.
Part one, part two. Well, in Serial Killers, it is basically a documentary about a man who's an athlete and his family, all get sick, become diabetic and die from heart disease. And he's like, what's going on? Where all the men in the family were athletic and, you know, healthy, and all of a sudden, what is going on? Well, he basically challenged orthodoxy about low fat and the standard diet, and went on a high fat, low carbohydrate diet. And in 30 days, this man improved all his markers. Everything improved out. Even his body fat content went down, and it really threw the whole notion of calories in, calories out, all calories are the same, totally upside down on its head.
Well, hold that thought, Tony. We're going to come back to it. We can take a little break right here in terms of allowing our wonderful station, Progressive Radio Network, to talk about other shows that you can hear about right here on the archives. And when we come back, we are going to continue our discussion with our guest today, attorney Mr. Tony Martinez. and we'll be talking about his personal journey after a health crisis and really reversing into remission diabetes that he had been told he had. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. On The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can say hello on Facebook, The Natural Nurse, like us there, or go to naturalnurse.com to get in touch with us. Today, our guest is Mr. Tony Martinez. I don't know how we say lawyers. Do we say Esquire Tony Martinez? He is
no,
an attorney.
No, just Tony, lawyer, and attorney, Tony Martinez. That's fine.
I always wonder about that because the amount of studying and work that you do to lead your profession is definitely major. And you have such a fantastic focus on so many areas. And now we're talking about your personal journey. I never heard of that movie, Serial Killers. What a great name. Serial as in C-E-R-E-A.
Oh, yeah. After you watch it, you'll never want to eat a bowl of cereal, or you'll understand that grains are probably, are really not conducive to, good health. Maybe under different circumstances and in a different environment, but, I mean, it was definitely a factor. I stopped eating grains last summer. So let me tell you the story. So when you get out of the hospital after you've had a heart attack and they put a stent in your heart, they put you on 5 different prescriptions, and they tell you you're pretty much going to have to be on them for the rest of your life. It's very depressing. They don't tell you about the side effects, and one of them is just leaving you in a state of depression. So I didn't want to accept this lot, and after I started doing research and I saw this documentary, I tell my doctor, hey, doc, even my cardiologist said, I want to do this diet. I'm going to go on a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet. See what happens. He said, well, we got to check you and monitor you for that. I said, fine. So I start the diet in July. And you can always find lots of information about low carb, high fat under that acronym, LCHF. You search it online, search it on Twitter, you'll find the whole universe of conversations. Or on Facebook, you just look at ketogenic. Type in that word and you'll see all the different pages. And, I discovered there was a community of types of diabetics who put their disease into remission and it went off medication or dramatically reduced their medications. Everybody's in a different state of the condition. So I go on this diet in July. And by the way, when I was admitted to the emergency room in March for the heart attack, I had an A1C of 7, which, by the way, is supposedly the target A1C according to the American Diabetes Association. But even at that level, what you learn when you look at the research, you are the canary in the coal mine of a cardiovascular event. You're like waiting for something to happen. And certainly after being 10 years a type 2 diabetic and having an A1C in the 6 to 7 range, voila, like the science predicted, I became another statistic and had a coronary event. Now, I go on this diet, and at first, the first week wasn't you stop eating bread, big deal, you stop eating grain. You start eating real food. You start having, instead of 2 eggs and bacon and toast and bagels and jam and buddy and preserves and pancakes and syrup, you start eating things like eggs and bacon and a tomato and an onion, and it's all mixed up together, and cheese, and you start, my diet today is basically hovers around 70% of my calories coming from fat, 20% from protein, and I keep carbs down to 10%. Why? Because here's what happened. So I started in July of 2014, by the end of September, I have my first set of labs done, and the doctor calls me up, and he says, hey, what are you doing? I go, why, doctor? He goes, congratulations. Your A1C has normalized. You're at a 5.5, which is the high end of the normal range. He says, you don't need to be on Janumet anymore. I can take you off that prescription.
Well, that's excellent. So your doctor was working with you in partnership. This is the perfect model. Even if he did not encourage you or believe in what you were about to do, he was willing to test you, work with you, and as the numbers change, change the intervention with pharmaceuticals.
Right. Yes, and that and my triglyceride went down to like close to like 110, which, and that is only through food, no medication because of the reduction of eating carbs. If you want to have high triglycerides are caused by eating too many carbs. So I get the triglyceride. I double my HDL cholesterol, which, by the way, is the most, is probably that and the triglycerides, from what I've read now in my opinion, and I'm not a doctor, so I mean, but I think those are probably the two most critical markers for your blood lipid profile. Is that HDL, it should be as high as possible, and your triglycerides should be as low as possible, because that relationship translates to something very important. It translates to what type of LDL cholesterol is present in your body. Is it the very atherogenic, artery-clogging type B LDL cholesterol, or is it the large, fluffy, more benign LDL particle A? They don't.
What an excellent description, and I wish that they would use that testing more so everybody would know those numbers.
Oh, yes. By the way, my doctor wanted to put me on a statin, and I said, no way. And I used even more colorful language to tell
That's
my
okay.
doctor. So the doctor says, well, keep it up. He says, keep doing what you're doing. So I really have stayed on it, and then when I went for my annual physical, I got my A1C down to 4.9. I even increased my HDL a few more points, and I got my triglycerides down to 90, 92. And that relationship, which is your triglycerides to HDL, your target, you're looking for a number that's 2 or less, because it's at that ratio where it's statistically not probable that you're producing any significant amount of LDL particle B.
Okay,
there's
well, let's,
well,
look, Tony,
go
before
ahead.
We
yeah.
run out of time, I want you to tell us, like, what are you eating that manifested this major, major change in your health?
Oh, well, I mean, so for this morning for breakfast, I had I had 6 ounces of nitrate-free, uncured bacon with one avocado that was mashed up with a red onion and tomatoes to make like a guacamole. And when I eat like that, I'll be good the rest of the day. I won't be hungry probably till the evening. So it's when you're in a state of nutritional ketosis and fat burning, your caloric requirements change, and your brain is really responsive. You're like, it will tell you when you're really hungry. And you'll eat that. And, you know, I woke up this morning and my fasting blood sugar was a nice 77. When I get fasting blood sugars at that number, 80, 82, 83, 77, that tells me I'm burning fat. I'm keeping now the master behind all of this, and we can have another show about this. It's really all about the insulin. And if I had to put it all in one word, is know and respect your insulin, and you can live a long, healthy life. And you can also eliminate your risks for heart disease. And, you know, I'm back in my weight from when I was in college. That's what this program. And I haven't killed myself at the gym either. So it's really it's an exciting approach. And I think more people, if they knew about it, they would do it. And it's a shame that doctors aren't looking this as like this should be the first treatment of choice before they start putting people full of drugs and medications that have all kinds of side effects and don't get that at the root cause of the problem.
Well, fantastic discussion, and thank you so much for sharing so many different levels of expertise that you have right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And tell us again the best place where people can get in touch with you. Perhaps they want some legal advice, and maybe they want you as a nutrition coach now. Who knows?
I actually want to work, looking forward to working with health insurance companies to create a benefit to work with people, because the average diabetic pays out of pocket over $5,000 per year. And if we can cut down those costs by half or more, that's what I'd like to see happen.
Well, thank you so much. And you know what? We'll have this show posted with your contact information on our website, on our archives, right at prn.fm. So until next time, thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, wishing that you stay healthy.